our house late at night. This is why the collection remains intact. This is why I've never sold a single painting. How could I? In the oils and pigments I store my memories of Ruth. In every painting I recall a chapter of our lives together. There is nothing more precious to me. They are all I have left of the wife I've loved more than life itself, and I will continue to stare and remember until I can do it no more. Before she passed, Ruth sometimes joined me on these late-hour wanderings, for she, too, enjoyed being drawn back in time. She, too, liked to retell the stories, even if she never realized that she was the heroine in all of them. She would hold my hand as we wandered from room to room, both of us reveling as the past came alive. My marriage brought great happiness into my life, but lately there's been nothing but sadness. I understand that love and tragedy go hand in hand, for there can't be one without the other. But nonetheless, I find myself wondering whether the trade-off is fair. A man should die as he had lived, I think. In his final moments, he should be surrounded and comforted by those he's always loved. But I already know that in my final moments, I will be alone.
Sophia. The next few weeks were one of those rare and wonderful interludes in which almost everything made Sophia believe nothing could be better. Her classes were stimulating, her grades were excellent, and even though she hadn't heard from the Denver Art Museum, her advisor recommended her for an internship at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. She would interview there over Christmas break. It wasn't a paid position, and she would probably have to commute from home if she got it, but it was MoMA. Never in her wildest dreams had she considered it a possibility. In the limited time that she spent at the sorority house, she'd noticed that Marcia was developing a prance in her step, the same one she got whenever she'd focused on someone special. She was in a perpetually good mood despite her denials that a guy had anything to do with it. At the same time, Mary Kate had significantly reduced her responsibilities at the sorority. Other than attending mandatory meetings, Sophia was, for the most part, exempt from sisterly obligations. Granted, this was probably the result of her own perfunctory attitude, but hey, whatever worked. Best of all, she hadn't run into Brian around campus, nor had he texted or called, making it easy to forget they'd ever dated. And then, of course, there was Luke. For the first time, she felt she understood what loving someone really meant. Since their weekend in the cabin, aside from Thanksgiving when she'd gone home to visit her family, they'd spent every Saturday night together at the ranch, mostly in each other's arms. In between kisses, the feel of his bare skin electric against her own, she reveled in the sound of his voice telling her over and over how much he adored her and how much she'd come to mean to him. In the darkness, she would gently trace her finger over his scars, sometimes finding a new one that she hadn't noticed before. They would talk until the early hours of the morning, pausing only to make love once more. The passion they felt for each other was intoxicating, something entirely different from what she'd felt with Brian. It was a connection that transcended the physical act. She'd grown to appreciate the quiet way Luke would slip from the bed first thing on Sunday mornings to feed the animals and check the cattle, trying his best not to wake her. Usually she would doze again, only to be awakened later with a cup of hot coffee and his presence beside her. Sometimes they'd while away an hour or more on the porch, or simply make breakfast together. Almost always they'd take the horses out, sometimes for an entire afternoon. The crisp winter air would turn her cheeks red and make her hands ache, yet in those moments, she felt connected to Luke and the ranch in a way that made her wonder why it had taken her so long to find him. As the holidays loomed closer, they would spend much of the weekend in the grove of Christmas trees. While Luke did the cutting, hauling, and tying up of the trees, Sophia worked the register. During lulls, she was able to study for finals. Luke had also begun to practice in earnest on the mechanical bull again. Sometimes she'd watch him atop the hood of a rusting tractor in the rickety barn. The bull was set up in a makeshift ring thickly padded with foam to break his falls. Usually he started off slowly, riding just hard enough to loosen his muscles, before setting the bull on high. The bull would spin and dip and shift directions abruptly, yet somehow Luke would stay centered, holding his free hand up and away from his body. He would ride 3 or 4 times, then sit with her while he recovered. Then he would climb into the ring again, the practice session sometimes lasting up to 2 hours. Though he never complained, she could recognize his soreness in the way he occasionally winced while shifting position or altering his walk. Sunday nights often found him in his bedroom, surrounded by candles as Sophia kneaded his muscles, trying to work out his aches and pains. Though they spent little time together on campus, they would sometimes go to dinner or a movie, and once they even visited a country bar where they listened to the same band that had been playing on the night they'd met, Luke teaching her to line dance at last. Luke made the world more vivid somehow, more real, and when they weren't together, she inevitably found her thoughts drifting toward him. The second week of December brought with it an early cold front, a heavy storm that blew down from Canada. It was the first snow of the season, and though most of it had melted by the following afternoon, Sophia and Luke spent part of the morning admiring the white-capped beauty of the ranch before hiking to the grove of Christmas trees on what ended up being the busiest day to that point. Later, as had become their habit, they headed over to his mother's. While Luke worked on replacing the brake pads in his truck, Linda taught Sophia how to bake. Luke hadn't been lying about how good her pies were, and they passed an enjoyable afternoon in the kitchen, chatting and laughing, their aprons coated with flour. Spending time with Linda reminded Sophia of her parents and all the sacrifices they'd made for her. Watching Linda and Luke tease and joke with each other made her wonder whether she'd have the same kind of relationship with her own parents someday. Gone would be the little girl they remembered. In her place would be not only their daughter, but perhaps a friend as well. Being part of Luke's life had made her feel more like an adult. With only a semester to go, she no longer wondered what the point of college had been. The ups and downs, the dreams and struggles, had all been part of the journey, she realized. A journey that led to a cattle ranch near a town called King, where she had fallen in love with a cowboy named Luke.
Again?
Marcia whined. She crossed her legs on the bed, pulling her oversized sweater down over her tights.
What? 12 weekends in a row at the ranch weren't enough for you?
You're exaggerating. Sophia rolled her eyes, adding a final coat of lip gloss. Next to her, her small bag was already packed.
Of course I am. But it's our last weekend before Christmas break. We leave on Wednesday, and I've barely spent any time with you at all this semester.
We're together all the time, Sophia protested.
No, Marcia said. We used to spend time together. Now you're at the ranch with him almost every weekend. You didn't even go to the winter formal last weekend. Our winter formal.
You know I don't care for those kinds of events.
Don't you mean he doesn't care for them?
Sophia brought her lips together, not wanting to sound defensive, but feeling the first hint of irritation in the way Marcia sounded. Neither of us wanted to go, okay? He was working and he needed my help. Marcia ran her hand through her hair, clearly exasperated.
I don't know how to say this without making you mad at me.
Say what?
You're making a mistake.
What are you talking about? Sophia put down her tube of lip gloss and turned to face her friend. Marcia tossed up her hands.
Think about how it looks. Imagine what you'd say if our roles were reversed. Say I was in a relationship for 2 years.
Not likely. Sophia stopped her.
Okay. And I know it's hard, but just pretend. I'm doing this for you. Say I went through a truly awful breakup and was hiding out in my room for weeks. Then out of the blue, I meet this guy. So I talk to him and visit him the next day, and then talk to him on the phone and visit him the next weekend. Pretty soon, I'm treating him like he's my whole world and spending every free minute with him. What would you think? That it just so happened that I met Mr. Wright while I was rebounding from a horrible breakup? I mean, what are the odds?
Sophia could feel blood begin to pound in her veins.
I don't know what you're trying to say. I'm saying that you could be making a mistake, and that if you're not careful, you could end up getting hurt.
I'm not making a mistake, Sophia snapped, zipping up the bag. and I'm not going to get hurt. I like spending time with Luke.
I know. Marcia softened, patting the bed beside her.
Sit down with me, she pleaded. Please.
Sophia debated before crossing the room and taking a seat on the bed. Marcia faced her.
I get that you like him, she said. I really do. And I'm glad you're happy again. But where do you see this going?
I mean, if it were me, I'd be happy to hang out and have fun, just see where it goes and live for the day. But I'd never let myself think for one minute that I'm going to spend the rest of my life with the guy.
I'm not thinking that either, Sophia interjected. Marcia picked at her sweater.
Are you sure? Because that's not the impression I get.
She paused, her expression almost sad.
You shouldn't have fallen in love with him. And every time you're with him, you're only making it worse for yourself.
Sophia flushed.
Why are you doing this?
Because you're not thinking clearly, Marcia answered. If you were, you'd be thinking about the fact that you're a senior in college, an art history major from New Jersey, for God's sake, while Luke rides bulls and lives on a ranch in rural North Carolina. You'd be wondering what was going to happen in 6 months once you graduate.
She stopped, forcing Sophia to concentrate on what she was really saying. Can you imagine living on a ranch for the next 50 years? Riding horses, herding cows, and cleaning out stalls for the rest of your life?
She shook her head.
No. Oh, Marcia said, cutting her off. Then maybe you see Luke living in New York City while you work at a museum? Maybe you imagine the two of you spending every Sunday morning at the latest brunch hotspots, sipping cappuccinos and reading the New York Times. Is that how you picture your future together?
When Sophia didn't answer, Marcia reached over and squeezed her hand.
I know how much you care about him, she went on. But your lives aren't just on different tracks. They're on different continents. And that means you're going to have to watch your heart from here on, because if you don't, it's going to end up breaking into all sorts of pieces.
You've been quiet tonight, Luke said between sips of hot cocoa. Sophia held her hands around her cup, staring out from their spot on the couch at the snow flurries beyond the window. The second snow of the season, though this one wasn't likely to stick. As usual, Luke had the fireplace going, but she couldn't shake the chill she felt.
I'm sorry, she said. I'm just tired.
She could feel his attention, which tonight for some reason left her strangely unsettled.
Do you know what I think?
He asked.
I think Marcia said something to you and it made you upset.
Sophia didn't answer right away.
Why would you say that?
She asked, her voice weaker than what she'd expected. He shrugged.
When I called to tell you that I was on my way, I could barely get you off the phone. By the time I got to the house, you'd gone silent. And I noticed the way you and Marcia kept glancing at each other. It was like the two of you had just shared some kind of confession and neither of you was happy about it.
The warmth from the cup radiated into her hands. You're very perceptive for a guy who can go a whole day without talking, she said, peering up at him.
That's why I'm perceptive.
His answer reminded her of the reasons they'd become so close so fast. But whether that was such a good idea wasn't quite so clear anymore.
You're thinking again, he chided, and it's beginning to make me nervous.
Despite the tension, she laughed.
Where do you think all this is going?
She suddenly asked, echoing Marcia's earlier question.
Between us, you mean?
I'm going to be graduating in the spring, just a few months from now. What's going to happen then? What happens when I move back home or get a job somewhere?
He leaned forward, putting his cup on the coffee table before slowly turning to face her again.
I don't know,
he said.
You don't know?
His face was unreadable.
I can't tell the future any more than you can.
That sounds like an excuse.
I'm not making excuses, he said. I'm just trying to be honest.
But you're not saying anything, she cried, hearing her own desperation and hating it.
Luke kept his voice steady.
Then how about this? I love you. I want to be with you. We'll find a way to make it work.
Do you really believe that?
I wouldn't have said it if I didn't.
Even if that means you have to move to New Jersey?
The firelight cast half his face in shadow.
You want me to move to New Jersey?
What's wrong with New Jersey?
Nothing, he said. I told you that I've been there before and that I liked it.
But?
For the first time, his eyes dropped.
I can't leave the ranch until I know my mom's going to be okay, he said with a certain finality. She understood his reasons, and yet... You want me to stay here, she said, after graduation.
No,
he shook his head.
I would never ask you to do that.
She couldn't hide her exasperation. Then again, what are we going to do? He put his hands on his knees.
We're not the first couple to face something like this. My feeling is, if it was meant to be, we'll figure it out. No, I don't know the answers, and no, I can't tell you how it's all going to play out. And if you were leaving today, I'd be more worried about it. But we've got 6 months, and things might be different by then. Maybe I'll be riding well, and I won't be so worried about the ranch. Or maybe I'll be digging up one of the fence posts one day and discover some buried treasure. Or maybe we'll end up losing the ranch entirely, and I'll have to move away. Or maybe you'll get a job in Charlotte, someplace close enough to commute. I don't know.
He leaned closer, no doubt trying to underscore his words.
The only thing I do know for sure is that if we both want to, we'll find a way to make it work.
She knew it was the only thing he could say, but the question of their future still left her feeling unsettled. She didn't say that, though. Instead, she scooted closer and let him slip his arm around her, his body warm against hers. She drew a long breath, wishing that time could somehow stop, or at least slow down.
Okay,
she whispered. He kissed her hair, then rested his chin on top of her head.
I love you, you know.
I know, she whispered. I love you too.
I'm going to miss you while you're gone.
Me too.
But I'm glad you'll spend some time with your family.
Me too.
Maybe I'll drive up to New Jersey and surprise you.
I'm sorry, she said. You can't do that.
Why not?
I'm not saying you're not welcome to visit me.
I'm just saying it won't be a surprise. You kind of ruined it.
He thought about that.
I guess I did, didn't I? Well, maybe I'll surprise you by not coming.
You better come. My parents want to meet you.
They've never met a cowboy before, and I know they have this crazy picture in their heads in which you walk around with a six-shooter and say things like,
Howdy, partner.
He laughed.
I guess I'll disappoint them.
No, she said. That's one thing you won't do. At that, Luke smiled.
How about New Year's Eve? You doing anything?
I don't know. Am I?
Now you are.
Perfect.
But you can't show up at night. You're going to have to spend some time with my parents, like I said.
Fair enough, he said.
He nodded toward the corner.
Do you want to help me decorate the tree?
What tree?
It's out back. I picked it out yesterday and dragged it over. It's kind of small and sparse, and it wasn't likely to sell, but I thought it might be nice in here. So you know what you'll be missing.
She leaned into him. I already know what I'll be missing. An hour later, Sophia and Luke stood back and admired their work.
It's not quite right,
Luke said, crossing his arms as he surveyed the tinsel-strewn tree.
It needs something more.
There's not much more we can do with it, Sophia said, reaching out to adjust a strand of lights. A lot of the branches are already sagging.
It's not that, he said. It's... Hold on, I'll be right back. I know exactly what it needs. Just give me a minute.
Sophia watched him disappear into the bedroom and return with a medium-sized gift box tied with ribbon. He walked past her and set it beneath the tree, then joined her again.
Much better, he said.
She looked over at him. Is that for me?
As a matter of fact, it is.
That's not fair, I didn't get you anything.
I don't want anything.
That may be, but now I feel bad.
Don't. You can make it up to me later.
She studied him. You knew I was going to say that, didn't you?
It was all part of my plan.
What's in it?
Go ahead,
he urged.
Open it.
She approached the tree and picked up the box. It was light enough for her to guess what was inside before she'd untied the ribbon and lifted the lid. She pulled it out and held it in front of her, examining it. Dyed black and made of straw, it was decorated with beads and a band that held in place a small feather.
A cowboy hat?
A nice one, he said, for girls.
Is there a difference?
Well, I would never wear one with a feather or beads. And I figured that since you were coming out here so much, you really needed your own.
She leaned over and kissed him.
It's perfect.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas.
She put it on and peered up at him coquettishly. How does it look?
Beautiful, he said. But then again, you always look beautiful.
19. Luke. With the beginning of the season less than a month away, and Sophia up in New Jersey, Luke stepped up his training regimen. In the days leading up to Christmas, he not only increased the duration of his rides on the mechanical bull by 5 minutes a day, but added strength training to the program. He'd never been fond of weightlifting, but no matter what he was doing in the way of work, which lately was primarily selling the remaining trees, he would duck away at the top of every hour and do 50 push-ups, sometimes finishing 400 or 500 in a day. Finally, he added pull-ups and core work to strengthen his stomach and lower back. By the time he collapsed in bed at the end of the day, he would fall asleep within seconds. Despite his sore muscles and exhaustion, he could gradually feel his skills coming back. His balance was improving, which made it easier to keep firmly seated. His instincts, too, were sharpening, allowing him to anticipate the reversals and pitches. In the 4 days following Christmas, he drove to Henderson County where he rode live bulls. A guy he knew had a practice facility there, and though the bulls weren't of the highest quality, practicing on the mechanical bull could do only so much. Live animals were never predictable, and though Luke wore both a helmet and a flak jacket, he found himself as nervous before these encounters as he'd been in McLeansville back in October. He pushed himself hard, and then even harder. The season began in mid-January, and he needed a strong start. He needed to win or place as high as possible in order to garner enough points to move up to the Major League Tour by March. By June, it might be too late. His mom saw what he was doing, and little by little she began to withdraw again. Her anger was evident, but her sadness was too, and he found himself wishing that Sophia were with them, if only to ease the growing awkwardness. Then again, he wished Sophia were here, period. With Sophia back in New Jersey for the holidays, Christmas Eve had been a quiet affair. Christmas Day was also subdued. He hadn't gone over to his mother's house until the early afternoon, and her tension was palpable. He was glad to have the Christmas tree sales behind him. Though they'd done well, the month in the grove meant everything else on the ranch had deteriorated further, and the weather wasn't helping matters. Luke's to-do list grew longer, and it worried him, particularly because he knew he'd be traveling a lot in the coming year. His absence would only make things harder for his mom. Unless, of course, he started winning right away. Always it came back to that. Despite the tree sales, which his mom used to add 7 pair to the herd, the farm's income wasn't going to be near enough to cover their payments. And with that in mind, Luke would trudge to the barn to practice, counting the days until New Year's Eve, when he'd finally see Sophia again. He left early in the morning, arriving in Jersey City a few minutes before lunch. After spending the afternoon with Sophia's parents and sister, neither Luke nor Sophia had wanted to battle the crowds in Times Square for New Year's Eve celebrations. Instead, they had a quiet dinner at an unpretentious Thai restaurant before returning to Luke's hotel. In the hours past midnight, Sophia lay on her stomach while Luke traced small circles on her lower back.
"Stop," she said, wiggling. "It's not going to work."
"What's not going to work?"
"I already told you that I can't stay. I have a curfew."
"You're 21 years old," he protested.
"But I'm at my parents' house and they have rules. And actually, they were being extra permissive by letting me stay out until 2. Normally, I have to be in by 1.
"What would happen if you stayed?"
"They'd probably think we slept together."
"We did sleep together."
She turned her head to face him. "They don't have to know that. And I have no intention of making it obvious.
But I'm only here for 1 night. I have to leave tomorrow afternoon."
"I know, but rules are rules. And besides, you don't want to get on my parents' bad side. They liked you. Although my sisters told me they were disappointed you weren't wearing your hat."
"I wanted to fit in."
"Oh, you did all right. Especially when you started talking about 4-H again. You noticed they had the same reaction I did when they found out you sell those poor little pigs for slaughter after raising them like pets."
"I've been meaning to thank you for bringing that up."
"You're welcome," Sophia said, her expression mischievous. "Did you see Delana's face when I explained it? I thought her eyes were going to pop out of her head. How's your mom doing, by the way?"
"She's all right."
I take it she's still mad at you?
You could say that.
She'll come around.
I hope so.
He leaned down, kissing her. Although she returned his kiss, he felt her hands move toward his chest and gently push him away.
You can kiss me all you want, but you still have to bring me back home. Can you sneak me into your room? Not with my sister there, that would be too weird. If I'd known you wouldn't stay over, I might not have driven all the way up here.
I don't believe you. He laughed before becoming serious again.
I missed you.
No, you didn't. You were too busy to miss me. Every time I called, you were always on the go. Between work and practice, you probably didn't even think about me.
I missed you,
he said again.
I know.
And I missed you too. She reached up, touching his face. But sadly, we're going to have to get dressed anyway. You're supposed to come over for brunch tomorrow, remember? Back in North Carolina, Luke made the decision to redouble his practice efforts. The first event of the season was less than 2 weeks away. The 2 days in New Jersey had given his body a chance to rest, and he felt good for the first time in weeks. The only problem was that it was as cold here as it had been in New Jersey, and he dreaded the chill of the barn even as he set out in its direction. He had just turned on the barn lights and was stretching before his first ride of the night when he heard the door swing open. He turned around just as his mom emerged from the shadows.
Hey, Mom,
he said, surprised.
Hi,
she said. Like him, she wore a heavy jacket. I went over to your house, and when I realized you weren't there, I figured this is where you might be. He said nothing. In the silence, his mom stepped into the foam-padded ring, sinking with every step until she stood on the opposite side of the bowl from him. Unexpectedly, she reached out and ran her hand over it.
I remember when your dad first brought this home, she said. It was all the rage for a while, you know. People wanted to ride these things because of that old movie with John Travolta, and practically every country bar put one in, only to watch the interest die out within a year or two. When one of those bars was being torn down, your dad asked if he could buy the bull. It didn't cost much, but it was still more than we could afford at the time, and I remember being furious with him. He'd been off in Iowa or Kansas or somewhere, and he drove all the way back here to drop it off before turning right around and heading to Texas for another set of rodeos. It wasn't until he got back that he realized it didn't work. He had to rebuild the thing pretty much from scratch, and it took him almost a year to get it working the way he wanted. But by then you came along, and he'd pretty much retired. It sat in the barn here collecting dust until he eventually put you on it. I think you were 2 years old at the time. I got pretty mad about that, too, even though it was barely moving. I somehow knew that you'd end up following in his footsteps. The thing is, I never wanted you to ride in the first place. I always thought it was a crazy way to try to make a living.
In her voice, he heard an uncharacteristic trace of bitterness.
Why didn't you say anything?
What was there to say? You were as obsessed as your dad. You broke your arm when you were 5, riding on a calf. But you didn't care. You were just mad because you couldn't ride for a few months. What could I do?
She didn't expect an answer, and she sighed.
For a long time, I hoped you'd grow out of it. I was probably the only mother in the world who prayed that her teenager would get interested in cars or girls or music, but you never did.
I liked those things, too.
Maybe. But riding was your life. It was all you ever really wanted to do. It was all you really dreamed about, and
she closed her eyes, an extended blink.
You had the makings of a star. As much as I hated it, I knew you had the ability and the desire and the motivation to be the best in the world. And I was proud of you. But even then, it broke my heart. Not because I didn't think you'd make it, but because I knew you'd risk everything to reach your dream. And I watched you get hurt over and over and try again and again.
She shifted her stance.
What you have to remember is that to me, you'll always be my child, the one I held in my arms right after you were born.
Luke stayed silent, overcome by a familiar shame.
Tell me, his mother said, searching his face. Is it something you feel like you couldn't live without? Do you still burn with the desire to be the best?
He stared at his boots before reluctantly lifting his head.
No,
he admitted.
I didn't think so,
she said.
Mom,
I know why you're doing this. Just like you know why I don't want you to. You're my son, but I can't stop you, and I know that too.
He drew a long breath, noting her weariness. Resignation hung on her like a tattered shroud.
Why did you come out here, Mom? He asked. It wasn't to tell me all that.
She gave a melancholy smile.
No. Actually, I came out here to check on you to make sure you were okay. And to find out how your trip went.
There was more, and he knew it. But he answered anyway.
The trip was good. Short, though. I feel like I spent more time in the truck than I did with Sophia.
That's probably right, she agreed. And her family?
Nice people. Close family. There was a lot of laughing at the table.
She nodded.
Good.
She crossed her arms, rubbing her sleeves. And Sophia?
She's great.
I see the way you look at her.
Yeah?
It's pretty clear how you feel about her, his mom stated.
Yeah?
He asked again.
It's good, she said. Sophia's special. I've enjoyed getting to know her.
Do you think there's a future there? He shifted from one foot to the other.
I hope so.
His mom looked at him seriously.
Then you should probably tell her. I already have.
No, his mom said, shaking her head. You should tell her.
Tell her what?
What the doctor told us, she said, not bothering to mince her words. You should tell her that if you keep riding, you'll most likely be dead in less than a year.
Ira. When you wander the house at night, Ruth suddenly interjects. You do not do as you say. What do you mean? I am startled to hear her voice again after this long silence. They are not like the diary you made for me. I could read all my letters, but you do not see all the paintings. Many of them are stacked together in overcrowded rooms, and you haven't seen them for years. And the ones you store in the oak boxes, you do not look at either. It is impossible for you to even open the boxes these days. This is true. Perhaps I should call someone, I say. I could hang different ones on the walls like you used to do. Yes, but when I did it, I knew how to arrange them to their best effect. Your taste is not so good. You simply had workers hang them in every open spot. I like the eclectic feel. It is not eclectic. It is tacky and cluttered, and it is a fire hazard. I smirk. It's a good thing no one comes to visit, then. No, she says. This is not good. You might have been shy, but you always drew strength from people. I drew strength from you, I say. Though it's dark in the car, I see her roll her eyes. I am talking about your customers. You always had a special way with them. This is why they remained customers, and it is why the shop failed after you sold it. Because the new owners were more interested in money than in providing service. Ruth might be right about this, but I sometimes wonder if the changing marketplace had more to do with it. Even before I retired, the shop had been drawing fewer customers for years. There were larger stores with more selection opening in other areas of Greensboro while people began to flee the city for the suburbs and businesses downtown began to struggle. I warned the new owner about this, but he was intent on moving ahead, and I walked away knowing I had given him a fair deal. Even though the shop was no longer mine, I felt a strong pang of regret when I realized it was going out of business after more than 90 years. The old haberdasheries, the kind I ran for decades, have gone the way of covered wagons, buggy whips, and rotary dial phones. My job was never like yours, though, I finally say. I didn't love it the way you loved yours.
I could take whole summers off.
I shake my head, or rather I imagine that I do. It was because of the children, I say. You may have inspired them, but they also inspired you. As memorable as our summers were, by the end you were always excited at the thought of being back in the classroom, because you miss the children. You miss their laughter and their curiosity and the innocent way they saw the world. She looks at me, her eyebrows raised.
And how would you know this?
Because, I say, you told me.
Ruth was a third-grade teacher, and to her it was one of the key educational periods in a student's life. Most of the students were 8 or 9 years old, an age she always considered an educational turning point. At that age, students are old enough to understand concepts that would have been foreign to them only a year earlier. But they are still young enough to accept guidance from adults with an air unquestioning trust. It was also, in Ruth's opinion, the first year in which students really began to differentiate academically. Some students began to excel, while others fell behind. Although there were countless reasons for this, in that particular school, in that era, many of her students, and their parents, simply didn't care. The students would attend school until the 8th or 9th grade, then drop out to work on the farm full-time. Even for Ruth, this was a challenge that was difficult to overcome. These were the kids that kept Ruth awake at night, the one she worried endlessly about, and she tinkered with her lesson plan for years, searching for ways to get through to them and their parents. She would have them plant seeds in Dixie cups and label them in an effort to encourage them to read. She would have the students catch bugs and name those as well, hoping to spark intellectual curiosity about the natural world. Tests in mathematics always included something about the farm or money. If Joe gathered 4 baskets of peaches from each tree, and there were 5 trees in each of the 6 rows, how many baskets of peaches will Joe be able to sell? Or, if you have $200 and you buy seed that costs $120, how much money do you have left? This was a world the students understood to be important, and more often than not, she got through to them. While some still ended up dropping out, they would sometimes come to visit her in later years to thank her for teaching them how to read and write and perform the basic math necessary to figure out their purchases at the store. She was proud of this, and proud of the students who eventually ended up graduating and going to college, of course. But every now and then, she had a student who made her realize again why she'd wanted to be a teacher in the first place. And that brings me to the painting above the fireplace.
You are thinking about Daniel McCallum, she says to me.
Yes, I say, your favorite student.
Her expression is animated, and I know her image of him is as vivid as the day she first met him.
At the time, she'd been teaching for 15 years.
He was very difficult.
That's what you told me.
He was very wild when he first arrived. His overalls were dirty all the time, and he could never sit still. I scolded him every day.
But you taught him to read.
I taught them all to read.
He was different, though.
Yes, she says.
He was bigger than the other boys, and he would punch the other students in the arm at recess, leaving bruises.
It is because of Daniel McCallum that my hair began to turn gray.
To this day I can remember her complaints about him, but her words, as they are now, had always been tinged with affection. He'd never been to school before. He didn't understand the rules.
He knew the rules. But at first he did not care. He sat behind a pretty young girl named Abigail and would constantly pull her hair. I would say to him, "You must not do this," but he would do it anyway. I finally had to seat him in the front row where I could keep my eye on him. And it was then that you learned he couldn't read or write.
Yes.
Even now, her voice is grim. And when you went to talk to his parents, you discovered they'd passed away. It turned out that Daniel was being raised by an older stepbrother and his wife, neither of whom wanted him to attend school at all. And you saw that the three of them were living in what was essentially a shack.
You know this because you went with me that day to the place he lived.
I nod. You were so quiet on the drive home.
It bothered me to think that in this rich country there were people who still lived as they did. And it bothered me that he had no one in his life who seemed to care about him.
So you decided not only to teach him but to tutor him as well, both before and after school.
He sat in the front row, she says. I would not be a good teacher if he learned nothing at all.
But you also felt sorry for him.
How could I not? His life was not easy. And yet, I eventually learned that there were many children like Daniel.
No, I say. For both of us, there was only one. It was early October when Daniel first entered our home. A gangly, tow-headed boy with rough country mannerisms and a shyness I hadn't anticipated. He did not shake my hand on that first visit, nor did he meet my eyes. Instead, he stood with his hands in his pockets, his gaze fixed on the floor. Though Ruth had tutored him after school, she worked with him again that evening at the kitchen table, while I sat in the living room, listening to the radio. Afterward, she insisted he stay for dinner. Daniel wasn't the first student she'd invited to our home for dinner, but he was the only one who ever came regularly. It was due partly to the family situation, Ruth explained. Daniel's stepbrother and his wife could barely keep the farm afloat and were resentful that the sheriff had ordered them to send Daniel to school at all. All the same, it didn't seem as though they wanted him around the farm, either. On the day Ruth visited, they sat on the porch smoking cigarettes and responded to Ruth's questions with indifferent, single-syllable answers. The next morning, Daniel came to school with bruises on his cheek and one eye as red as a ruby. The sight of his face nearly broke Ruth's heart, making her all the more determined to help him. But it wasn't simply the obvious signs of abuse that upset her. When tutoring him after school, she often heard his stomach rumble, though when asked, he denied that he was hungry. When Daniel finally admitted that he sometimes went days without eating, her first instinct was to call the sheriff. Daniel begged her not to, if only because he had nowhere else to go. Instead, she ended up inviting him to dinner. After that initial visit to our home, Daniel began to eat with us two or three times a week. As he grew more comfortable with us, the shyness evaporated, replaced by an almost formal politeness. He shook my hand and addressed me as Mr. Levinson, always making a point of asking how my day had been. The seriousness of his demeanor both saddened and impressed me, perhaps because it seemed a product of his prematurely hard life. But I liked him from the beginning and grew more fond of him as the year progressed. For her part, Ruth would eventually come to love him like a son. I know that in this day and age it's considered inappropriate to use such a word when describing a teacher's feeling for a student, and perhaps it was inappropriate even then. But hers was a motherly love, a love born of affection and concern, and Daniel blossomed under Ruth's care. Over and over I would hear her tell him that she believed in him, and that he could be anything he wanted to be when he grew up. She emphasized that he could change the world if he wanted. make it a better place for himself and others, and he seemed to believe her. More than anything, he seemed to want to please her, and he stopped acting up in class. He worked hard to become a better student, surprising Ruth with the ease with which he learned. Though uneducated, he was highly intelligent, and by January he was reading as well as his classmates. By May, he was nearly 2 years ahead, not only in reading, but in all the other subjects as well. His memory was remarkable. He was a veritable sponge, soaking up everything that Ruth or I ever told him. As if keen to know Ruth's heart, he showed an interest in the art that hung on our walls, and after dinner, Ruth often walked him through the house to show him the paintings we'd collected. He would hold Ruth's hand and listen as she described them, his eyes flickering from the paintings to her face and back again. He eventually came to know the names of all the artists, as well as their styles, and in this fashion, I knew that he had come to care for Ruth as much as she cared for him. Once, Ruth asked me to take a photograph of them together. After she presented it to him, he clung to it for the rest of the afternoon, and I saw him staring at it some time later, his face etched with wonder. Whenever Ruth dropped him off back at home, he never once forgot to thank her for the time she spent with him. And on the last day of school, before he ran off to play with his friends, he told her that he loved her. By then, the idea had taken root in her mind to ask Daniel if he wanted to live with us permanently. We talked about this, and in truth, I wouldn't have minded. Daniel was a pleasure to have around our home, and I told her as much. But by the end of the school year, Ruth still wasn't sure how to broach the subject with him. She wasn't sure whether Daniel would agree or even if he desired such a thing, nor did she know how to suggest this to his stepbrother. There was no guarantee that such a thing would even be legally allowed. So for all these reasons, she said nothing on that final day. Instead, she decided to postpone the matter until after we returned from our summer trip. But during our travels, Ruth and I spoke of Daniel frequently. We resolved to do whatever we could to make such an arrangement possible. When we finally returned to Greensboro, however, the shack stood empty, apparently abandoned for weeks. Daniel didn't return to school in August, nor were there any requests for his records to be forwarded. No one seemed to know where he'd gone or what had happened to the family. Students and other teachers soon forgot about him. But for Ruth, it was different. She cried for weeks when she realized not only that he was gone, but that he might be gone forever. She made a point of visiting the neighboring farms, hoping that someone could tell her where the family had gone. At home, she would eagerly sort through the mail, hoping to find a letter from him, and she could never hide her disappointment when day after day, none arrived. Daniel had filled a hole in Ruth that I could not, something that had been missing in our marriage. In that year, he'd become the child she'd always wanted, the child I could never give her. I would love to tell you that Ruth and Daniel reconnected, that later in life he contacted her, if only to let her know how he was doing. She worried about him for years, but with the passage of time, Ruth began to mention his name less frequently, until finally she stopped mentioning him at all. Yet I knew she never forgot about him, and that part of her never stopped looking for him. It was Daniel she was looking for as we drove the quiet country roads, passing run-down farms. It was Daniel she hoped to see whenever she returned to school after a summer spent in distant studios and galleries. Once, she thought she spotted him on the streets of Greensboro during a Veterans Day parade. But by the time we were able to make our way through the crowds, he was already gone, if he'd ever really been there at all. After Daniel, we never again had a student in our home. There is a bone-chilling cold in the car, the after-effect of the window I opened earlier.
Frost glitters on the dashboard now, and every time I breathe, a cloud forms beyond my lips. Though I'm no longer thirsty, my throat and stomach remain chilled from the snow. The cold is inside and outside, everywhere, and I can't stop shivering. Beside me, Ruth stares out the window, and I realize that I can see starlight beyond the pane. It is not yet light, but the moonlight makes the snow on the trees glow silver, and I can tell that the worst of the weather has passed. Tonight, the snow on the car will crust as it continues to freeze, but sometime tomorrow, or the next day, the temperature will rise, and the world will shake off the white embrace of winter as the snow begins to melt. This is both good and bad. My car may become visible from the road, which is good. But I need the snow to live, and within a day or two, it might be gone completely.
You are doing fine for now, Ruth tells me. Do not worry about tomorrow until you have to.
Easy for you to say, I reply, sulking. I'm the one in trouble here.
Yes, she says matter-of-factly. But it is your fault. You should not have been driving.
We're back to this again?
She turns to me with a wry grin. She is in her 40s now and wears her hair short. Her dress is cut in simple lines, in the bright red hues she preferred with oversized buttons and elegant pockets. Like every other woman in the 1960s, Ruth was a fan of Jacqueline Kennedy. You brought it up.
I was looking for sympathy.
You are complaining. You do this more now that you are older. Like with the neighbor who cut down the tree, and the girl at the gas station who thought you were invisible.
I wasn't complaining, I was observing. There's a difference.
You should not complain. It is not attractive.
I'm many years removed from being attractive.
No,
she counters. In this you are wrong. Your heart is still beautiful. Your eyes are still kind. And you are a good and honest man. This is enough to keep you beautiful forever. Are you flirting with me?
She raises an eyebrow. I do not know. Am I?
She is, I think. And for the first time since the accident, if only for a moment, I actually feel warm. It is strange, I think, the way our lives turn out. Moments of circumstance, when later combined with conscious decisions and actions and a boatload of hope, can eventually forge a future that seems predestined. Such a moment occurred when I first met Ruth. I wasn't lying when I told Ruth that I knew in that instant we would one day be married. Yet experience has taught me that fate is sometimes cruel, and that even a boatload of hope is sometimes not enough. For Ruth, this became clear when Daniel entered our lives. By then she was over 40 and I was even older. It was another reason she couldn't stop crying after Daniel left. Back then, social expectations were different, and both of us knew that we were too old to adopt a child. When Daniel disappeared from our lives, I couldn't escape the conclusion that fate had conspired against her for the last and final time. Though she knew about the mumps and had married me anyway, I knew that Ruth had always clung to a secret hope that the doctor had somehow been mistaken. There was no definite proof, after all, and I admit that I had nurtured a slim hope as well. But because I was so deeply in love with my wife, it was seldom at the forefront of my thoughts. We made love frequently in our first years of marriage, and though Ruth was reminded every month of the sacrifice she had made by marrying me, she wasn't initially bothered by it. I think she believed that will alone, that her profound desire for a child, would somehow make it happen. Her unspoken belief
was that our time would come. And this, I think, was the reason we never discussed adoption. It was a mistake, I know that now, but I didn't know it then. The 1950s came and went, and our house slowly filled with art. Ruth taught school, and I ran the store, and even though she was growing older, part of her still held out hope. And then, like the long-awaited answer to a prayer, Daniel arrived. He became first her student, and then the son she had always longed for. But when the illusion suddenly ended, only I remained. And it wasn't quite enough. The next few years were hard for us. She blamed me, and I blamed myself as well. The blue skies of our marriage turned gray and stormy, then bleak and cold. Conversations became stilted, and we began to argue for the first time. Sometimes it seemed to be a struggle for her to sit in the same room with me. She spent many weekends at her parents' house in Durham. Her father's health was declining, and there were times when we didn't speak for days. At night, the space between us and the bed felt like the Pacific, an ocean impossible for either of us to swim across. She did not want to, and I was too afraid to try, and we continued to drift further apart. There was even a period when she wondered whether she wanted to remain married to me. And in the evenings, after she'd gone to bed, I would sit in the living room, wishing that I was someone else, the kind of man who'd been able to give her what she wanted. But I couldn't. I was broken. The war had taken from me the only thing she'd ever wanted. I was sad for her and angry with myself. And I hated what was happening to us. I would have traded my life to make her happy again. But I didn't know how. And as crickets sounded on warm autumn nights, I'd bring my hands to my face, and I would cry, and cry, and cry.
I would never have left you, Ruth assures me. I am sorry I made you think such things.
Her words are leaden with regret. But you thought about it.
Yes, she said, but not in the way you think. It was not a serious idea.
All married women think such things at times, men too. I never did.
I know, she says, but you are different.
She smiles, her hand reaching out for mine. She takes it, caressing the knots and bones.
I saw you once, she says to me, in the living room.
I know, I say.
Do you remember what happened next?
You came over and held me.
It was the first time I had seen you cry since that night in the park after the war, she says. It scared me very much. I did not know what was wrong.
It was us, I say. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to make you happy anymore.
There was nothing you could do, she says.
You were so angry with me.
I was sad, she says. There is a difference.
Does it matter? Either way, you weren't happy with me.
She squeezes my hand, her skin soft against my own. You are a smart man, Ira, but sometimes I think you do not understand women very well.
In this, I know she is right.
I was devastated when Daniel went away. I would have loved for him to become part of our lives, and yes, I was sad that we never had children. But I was also sad because I was in my 40s. Even though that might not make sense to you, I did not mind my 30s. That was when I felt, for the first time in my life, that I was actually an adult. But for women, older than 40 is not always so easy. On my birthday, I couldn't help but think that I had already lived half my life. And when I looked in the mirror, a young woman no longer stared back at me. It was vain, I know. but it bothered me, and my parents were getting older too. That was why I went to visit them so often. By then, my father had retired,